This is WFYI News Now. It's December 6th, and I'm Darian Benson. Later in the show, after more than a dozen incidents of sexual abuse surfaced at a youth treatment facility in northern Indiana, the state kept sending boys there.
The consequences of this could play out in any number of ways, and both the kids and society will probably pay for it for a long time.
Last week, I sat down with the reporters who broke this story. That's coming up. But first, these headlines. The Indiana Court of Appeals today will look at whether Indiana's near-total abortion ban violates some people's religious freedom. Brandon Smith looks ahead to the next hearing in a case that dates back to last year.
A group of anonymous women and the organization Hoosier Jews for Choice sued the state in September of last year, arguing the abortion ban infringes on their religious beliefs. A Marion County judge agreed, ruling that the ban likely violates Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The state tried to appeal that ruling directly to the Indiana Supreme Court, which denied the direct appeal. Instead, the case will go through the normal appeals process, and its next step is this week's hearing before a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals. However that panel eventually rules, the case will almost certainly be appealed then to the state Supreme Court, meaning a final outcome in this legal challenge to the abortion ban is many months away. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And the state is asking a federal judge to dismiss a second lawsuit challenging a new law that criminalizes anyone who gets within 25 feet of police after being told to stop. A group of media organizations and Indianapolis newspaper and television stations sued the state in October over the law. They argue it's unconstitutional, allowing law enforcement to prevent the press from documenting police activity. But attorneys for the state argue the lawsuit should be dismissed because it's purely hypothetical. The media outlets and organizations have not been affected by the law, and the state says they haven't shown that they likely will be. The state also says the lawsuit shouldn't move forward because there's already another lawsuit, filed in August, challenging the law. That case involves a citizen in South Bend who regularly films law enforcement for his YouTube channel, and the new 25-foot bubble was applied to him by police at the scene of a shooting. And Indigo is hosting a series of open houses this week to give residents a chance to check out plans for the Blue Line. Jill Sheridan reports the line will be Indianapolis's third bus rapid transit, or BRT, route.
The Blue Line will provide faster bus service across the city from Cumberland to the Indianapolis International Airport. Planning for the line is almost complete, and Indigo Chief Public Affairs Officer Leslie Gordon says they're taking it to the public.
We're really trying to get feedback from neighbors and business owners so that we make sure we understand how their customers access their business, how neighbors get to their homes.
Indigo is offering local businesses the opportunity for one-on-one meetings. Businesses can benefit from signage and access assistance once construction starts. The Blue Line is expected to open in 2027. I'm Jill Sheridan, WFYI News.
Meetings are planned today at People for Urban Progress and tomorrow at the Cumberland Town Hall. The state has reached a settlement in its lawsuit against a Northwest Indiana medical company over a ransomware event that put personal and protected health information at risk. Abigail Ruman reports the agreement includes no admission of guilt on the behalf of the provider.
CarePoint, an ear, nose, throat, sinus, and hearing provider, will pay the state $125,000 and develop a written information security program to protect consumers and ensure further compliance with the law. The lawsuit claimed CarePoint was aware of security risks before a ransomware event exposed the information of about 45,000 Indiana patients. The settlement requires CarePoint to develop and maintain systems and plans to protect sensitive patient information. This includes designating an individual to be a HIPAA security officer, who will be responsible for overseeing the security program. CarePoint will also have to meet training requirements for all personnel with access to personal information and protected health information, including tabletop exercises to test its preparedness to respond to security risks. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Abigail Ruman.
And for our final story today, a warning. This next story talks about sexual abuse. A teenage boy said that a female staffer at an Indiana youth treatment facility gave him lollipops, then engaged in physically intimate contact. More than a dozen similar incidents of abuse surfaced at Pierston Woods Academy in northern Indiana, but the state kept sending boys there anyway, according to a new investigation by the Indy Star and ProPublica. Last week, I spoke with the two reporters who worked on the story, Tony Cook and Emily Hopkins, to learn more. I want to start with Emily. Your investigation is centered around an organization called Lasting Change. What do we know about it?
So Lasting Change is a faith-based nonprofit organization based in northern Indiana. It manages several companies, including Pearson Woods Academy, which is a 48-bed residential facility that treats boys for substance abuse disorders and sexually harmful behaviors, and is the Indiana Department of Child Services' largest contractors. And the last thing to note here is that it is a deeply has some deep political connections in Indiana. Former vice president and Indiana governor is a supporter, has spoken at fundraisers for Lasting Change companies, and its current CEO, Tim Smith, is currently running for a Republican campaign for Congress.
And Tony, you've both spent months reporting the story. What prompted you to start looking into the specific facility, Pearson Woods Academy?
Yeah, I first heard about Lasting Change when it was lobbying at the State House for liability protections. And that's when we learned, primarily from information gathered as part of a lawsuit, that there were multiple allegations of sexual abuse there. And then Emily was pursuing a similar line of reporting, and so we decided to team up.
In your investigation, you found that the Department of Child Services didn't do enough to protect children, and it even continued to funnel millions of dollars despite evidence of abuse happening there. Emily, can you tell us more about how this happened?
What we found was that its internal policies, Pearson Woods' internal policies, instructed staff members to report allegations of abuse to supervisors before reporting it to DCS or to police. In some training materials that we obtained, it even showed a flow chart where an allegation of abuse would travel up the chain of command from direct care staff to the director of the facility, who would then determine if that was even worth reporting to DCS. So we found this policy, but we also found that DCS knew about this policy, had asked Pearson Woods to revise the policy, and approved a subsequent policy that included the same instructions to staff to report allegations to supervisors before the state or to police, which our experts have told us that that runs counter to the law, which says that you need to report allegations of abuse to DCS or police immediately. Even 4 hours is too long to wait in some cases.
We also obtained emails that show that DCS frequently screened out reports of abuse allegations that they received. So we found that there were like 17 reports from 2017 to 2021 that they screened out, which means they just didn't look into it. They didn't investigate it. And in at least two of those cases, the records indicated that DCS declined to look into allegations involving staff members at Pearson Woods who were later found either by a police investigation or a subsequent DCS investigation to have, in fact, abused residents.
The story includes many shocking and troubling details. What struck you the most while reporting this story?
For me, I think it's that you have a place that's supposed to provide, you know, a safe environment for vulnerable teenagers to get treatment that they need. And many of them have been abused themselves. And so to have them be victimized in a place like that is just really damaging, obviously. And it's a bad thing, not just for them, I think, but for society as a general, in general, because, you know, the consequences of this could play out in any number of ways. And both the kids and society will probably pay for it for a long time.
Tony and Emily, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
That was reporters Tony Cook and Emily Hopkins. Their investigation was recently published in the Indy Star and ProPublica. That's all for today's episode of WFYI News Now. Our podcast is produced by the following people who live in your community: Aubriana Heron, Drew Dodlin, Kendall Antron, who composed the music for this podcast, and me, Darian Benson. Our news director is Sarah Neil Estes. If you liked today's episode, remember to subscribe and share. And follow WFYI on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube to check in on our newsroom throughout the day. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.